Hello and welcome to this week's TES podcast. I'm reporter Dave Speck, and joining me is some of the usual news team. We've got reporter John Roberts. Hiya, John.
Hello there.
We've got reporter Catherine Luff. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. Hi.
We've got deputy news editor Mary Louise Clues. Mary Louise, hello.
Hi there.
Now, coming up, why the government has utterly failed to assess the cost of COVID for schools, and why heads are calling for major policy changes post-pandemic. But first, the bubble system this week has been described as disproportionate and unsustainable after 1 in 20 pupils were left off school and in isolation. But is there light at the end of the tunnel? Because Education Secretary Gavin Williamson suggested bubbles could be lifted before the summer holidays. Mary Louise, let me first ask you, would this presumably be so pupils can take part in summer schools and catch-up programmes and that sort of thing? What did the Education Secretary actually say?
They seem to imply that. That's right, Dave. So he said, when asked about this, he said, when it comes to summer activities, we want all children to be able to be part of that, whether that's the holiday activity and food programmes, and whether that's the additional summer schools that schools are laying on. And that is why, as part of step four, we're looking at lifting those restrictions and lifting those bubbles that currently schools have to sort of operate within that guidance of.
Yeah. Will certainly please a lot of MPs and scientists who this week have been calling for a rethink of bubble rules. But it's probably worth mentioning first what actually were the absence rates this week, because there was a meteoric rise, wasn't there, Catherine?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So they rose to 5.1% of pupils in state funded schools being off. So this is quite a significant rise from 3.3% who were off on the 17th of June, and then 1.2% only were off on the 10th of June. And the other thing to mention is that there were also kind of a rising number of staff absences as well. So it just sort of shows that obviously schools are now struggling to deal with the amount of students who are having to self-isolate.
Yeah, and it translates to something like 279,000 children in England isolating because of a possible contact with a COVID case. And then you've got this group of 48 MPs, Mary Louise, haven't we? They wrote a letter to the Prime Minister, didn't they?
Yeah, well, there's been a huge amount of pressure in sort of more right-leaning newspapers as well this week, and I think this sort of led to this letter being sent to the Prime Minister, 48 MPs, including, I should say, the chair of the Education Select Committee, Robert Halfen, who's MP for Harlow. And I think he, not in this letter, but he talked separately about some children becoming sort of ghost children or something.
Oh, yeah.
because they're never in school. And so they wrote to the Prime Minister and said, come on, we can't wait till September. This needs to happen on July the 19th when you're planning on lifting wider restrictions in society. But the Prime Minister's responded saying, come on, we need some patience around this. It's not something we can just dismiss lightly. And there has been, I mean, we'll come on to talk about this, but I think there's since been a bit of a backlash from the profession on this. But I think, Dave, you spoke to Sage, so it's not just these MPs. Sage are actually starting to advise, aren't they?
I didn't speak to Sage. I just heard Professor Russell Viner on Radio 4 on Monday morning.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I was very keen to listen to what he had to say, and I did a little story that... I think his point was that as adults and vulnerable people become vaccinated, we need to think about the balance between how much COVID rules in schools protect broader society and how much they harm children. But John, I mean, not everyone has been in favour of ending bubbles so soon, have they?
No, we've seen pushback from two unions so far, at least one, the NHT, which kind of sounded a note of caution, didn't necessarily come out overtly against it, and then a much more stark kind of response from Unison, which obviously is a school staff union as well, basically saying it would be dangerous. And I guess the point to say is, I think the rationale behind that is they're saying we're almost in a position where COVID is getting to the point where it's causing too much disruption in school, so let's relax the COVID restrictions. And I think that for some people that seems contradictory, because in the short term, you'll definitely see less kids self-isolating. But part of the reason we've got such big numbers self-isolating now is cases are going up. And if you do away with bubbles, and they've also talked about doing away with the need to self-isolate as something else, then you're going to have more COVID in schools, and not all school staff have been vaccinated. And it could lead to more disruption with more kids with actual COVID, even if you've got less people off-isolating, if that makes sense.
It does. And from what the Prime Minister said when he urged patience, it seemed to me that he's in favour of maintaining bubbles right until the end of this term, because he described the summer holidays as a natural fire break or something, which would suggest, and it does seem like common sense, doesn't it, to keep everything in place until the end of term. Why would you change anything with just 1 week to go?
And whatever they do, then they need to make it clear as soon as possible, because, you know, the profession are at the point of saying, well, they are saying, I think, today that enough is enough. I mean, yesterday we had a letter from Jeff Bunn to the Prime Minister, Jeff Bunn, head leader of the ASCOL Head Teachers Union, saying that they're... he was absolutely dismayed. I can't remember the exact language he used, because there's been another letter today when they've talked about anger and dismay. But
he was kind of dismayed that the government appeared to be blaming schools for sending too many pupils home in bubbles when they were merely following the guidance, right?
Absolutely. And the DfE have said, and Catherine's had a bit of a conversation with the DfE on this, but the DfE have said, well, yeah, I mean, they are interpreting the guidance overzealously. You know, we've only ever said that close contacts needed to be sent home, not whole school bubbles. I mean, we were having a conversation about this yesterday, weren't we, Catherine? And I just was saying, have policymakers spent any time in primary schools in you know, at any point, because, you know, I have a year one age child. She's her whole bubble was sent home last week, you know, quite rightly so. You can't divide which 5 year olds and, you know, which 5 year olds and 6 year olds have been spending time together. They're all climbing on top of each other. They play with different, you know, it's not the same situation as perhaps secondary schools, where you have sort of set desks where people always sit, and they have their friendship groups, and they have the places they sit in the classroom. So it's been all sorts of kind of backlash over that.
It's really, as well, I thought it was interesting because Robert Halfen also said that the guidance had been quite confusing or conflicting from different arms of Public Health England and the DfE. And it is interesting that, you know, rightly or wrongly, whether schools are sending home whole bubbles and maybe the guidance isn't to do that, it just shows that what you really are meant to do has not been very clearly communicated. Yeah, as you say, for a lot of schools, particularly if they're a smaller school and they've got younger pupils, being able to identify who your close contact is of a child who has a case is going to be nearly impossible.
Sorry, I was just going to say very quickly, two bits that jump out to me about it is, one is we've basically got, and it returns to something we've seen before earlier in the COVID crisis, educators been asked to make public health calls, and they're always going to defer to public health experts and the advice that they get from their local directors and from the government. And they do their best to interpret the guidance, a massive new extra responsibility put on them at the height of a pandemic. And it feels like they're almost been blamed now for kind of sullying the national mood music, which is that we're all getting out of this on July the 19th. And yet there's parents up and down the country saying, well, hang on, we're in chaos in our area because there's My kids are all at home because bubbles are closing left, right and centre. But they are closing left, right and centre because COVID's on the rise in schools. Now, that you know, the bubbles haven't become more restrictive all of a sudden. It's just that because of the vaccination, because we feel like we're heading in the right direction, it seems to me like there's been a big political pushback, as if this is really like unhelpful from schools. But all they're doing is following the guidelines that have always been there. It's COVID that's going up. That's the reason people are isolating. And that's very much a personal little rant, but yeah, don't know.
John, I'm just thinking about this analysis piece that you did yesterday, looking at what the situation could look like in September. And
yes, I mean, so Sorry, David.
No, go. What, I was going to ask, what would it look like in September? What are the options?
Well, I mean, this is it. So essentially what we look like we're going to see is bubbles potentially going and the need to self-isolate potentially going. And then the question is that what would that be replaced by? Now, we know that the government is doing trials at the moment where they're in some schools, a couple of hundred schools in the country, instead of close contacts of COVID having to isolate, they take a daily lateral flow test. And while that comes back negative, they can stay in school. Now, Gavin Williamson's indicated that they're going to look at the findings of that trial. So it could be that that basically becomes the kind of the bottom brick of COVID management. It's worth saying, and I referred to this in the piece, that they wanted to do that in January. That was their plan, to basically, in secondary schools at least, and the health advice changed because of the prevalence of the variant at the time in January that kind of led us into a national lockdown, that the balance of risk had changed. So that definitely comes with a risk of increasing COVID. There's then also been debate about whether vaccination effectively is the way out of this. And so do we need to find a way of quickly fast tracking to make sure the entire school staff is vaccinated? And Kate Green, Labour's Shadow Education Secretary, was asked about whether they'd be in favour of compulsory vaccination. And she was very cautious about it, but didn't rule it out. And then there's the big debate that's ongoing at the moment as well about whether we vaccinate teenagers and whether as well that's whether there's a, as well as a health argument for doing that, an education argument for doing it, because if everyone's vaccinated, it'll reduce the prevalence of COVID in secondary schools. Disruption will be down and education is effectively. I spoke to one public health director who said that education outcomes are public health outcomes, i.e. if you do better in education, you are likely to lead a life that is more healthy. So there's a direct correlation between education disruption and people's potential future health, which is a really interesting point because you think about vaccine, the question of the vaccine, just in terms of how risky is COVID for them against how potentially could there be any risk associated with the vaccine. So that's the other thing. Then there's questions about ventilation as well and whether the DfE will look at that in any detail, because again, that's something that we often hear in other settings, that fresh air and ventilation is kind of key to reducing your risk. So could there be any major shift on that? But it does seem, I think one thing that's striking to me at the moment is that in order to minimise COVID disruption, we're looking to minimise COVID controls. And it feels like that could very much go one of two ways, because you can absolutely see that it'll cause less disruption if, you know, you're just sending a handful of kids home that have definitely sat right next to the case. But at the same time, you're inevitably creating the risk that the virus will spread more. And going into September, what will that look like? It's a difficult call.
I just hope that whatever happens, heads get plenty of notice ahead of.
Well, they already haven't. Yeah, absolutely. But they already haven't. You know, September is working weeks away.
Indeed.
You know what I mean?
Whatever
comes now is very late in the day into their summer holidays, and it is. We talked about Groundhog Day before, but we do. It feels like life comes too fast for the DfE. Do you know what I mean? They don't seem to be able to get out in front of it in terms of guidance.
And isn't the bottom line now that heads are saying, haven't they? Sort of breaking news just before we came on the podcast was heads have written to Gavin Williamson, or three joint major unions, ASCL, NHT and the NEU, saying they feel like the treatment that they're getting is starting to feel like contempt, and just saying, look, you know, we've been doing our best for 18 months trying to manage essentially a public health response in schools, and we're getting criticised for it. We're getting told that we're misinterpreting the guidance. We're being asked to work on our holidays. They're essentially saying enough is enough, aren't they, John? I know you've looked at the letter as well.
It's definitely worth, we've got a story on our website, and it's definitely worth reading it and the letter in full, because it's, even in the current context where the relationship between leaders and the DfE has been strained for ages, it's a really astonishing letter. I think one of the trigger points was the thing we referred to earlier, which is the way that Downing Street and the kind of, and cabinet sources in national media have kind of briefed the idea that schools are, in the letter it says, capriciously sending more kids home than's necessary. I heard Jacob Rees-Mogg calling on school leaders to show leadership and not always say no all the time, as if this crisis is basically as a result of mismanagement of COVID decisions at school level. But it basically, the letter, I think what's really striking in the letter is that they literally say, you've said bubbles are going, but you haven't told schools this. We understand from officials that we might have to be working in the summer holidays and track and trace, but you haven't told schools this. Some schools are done in a week or so, and we don't know what's expected in September. And the other thing they've called for, I think, and it's similar to what the NEU called for a little bit back, is that if there is to be asymptomatic testing sites back in schools, that's the other thing I should have mentioned from my piece, Dave. That's the other big thing, I guess. That if that happens, it should be public health people administering and running it, and not teachers and school staff.
Just on that point about testing, and we've got to move on to the next thing in a minute. But Professor Viner did say that there's going to be more PCR tests available, you know, the more accurate tests in September, because they wouldn't be needed by adults so much. So I suppose that throws it one sort of tiny glimmer of light into all this darkness, doesn't it? But John, if I can keep you on as you are, because you've done this piece about the National Audit Office report that's published today. And that's another kind of bleak picture about school funding, isn't it? And how the DfE has completely failed to assess the proper cost of COVID to schools. Would that be fair?
Yes, that's one of their key findings, that essentially, although the government pointed to, at the time of the report, more than £3 billion worth of money going into COVID, that they don't know whether the stuff that they've given them to meet extra costs will actually meet the need, and that a lot of the people that they spoke to said that it wouldn't. So one of the key recommendations of this report is for the government to systematically assess exactly how much COVID has cost over time, both in terms of cost and lost income, and also to bear in mind, I suppose, that there isn't a uniform cost to schools. Do you know what I mean? Depending on where you are and how COVID has hit
absolutely.
You, then it's going to be a very mixed picture. But that's a really sort of strong finding, because obviously that affects every school to a different degree. And then the other kind of key thing with the report is looking at the national funding formula, which I'd say a little bit about that. So that was brought in a couple of years ago, and it's been something that's been talked about for like while ever I've been covering education, is this idea of trying to level the playing field on school funding. But what the NAO report points out is that the government's attempt to do this has effectively meant that you are shifting money away from schools in less deprived areas.
That's been said for a number of years now, hasn't it? This levelling up policy means that you're actually giving money to schools in more affluent areas.
Yeah, exactly that. And so basically there's kind of one of the things that's driven it is there's a minimum level that they've kind of established that no school's going to drop below. But there are more schools in more affluent areas that were below it. So whereas most of the schools in more deprived areas weren't, because of just the way school funding has been weighted over the years.
Because they've got more special needs, they've got more deprivation.
Exactly.
A whole raft of problems which other schools don't have. And that's why they're getting more money in the first place.
Quite. And it's so in a way, there's just this. And one of the other NEO recommendations is that the DfE needs to have a look and decide whether it is happy that it is matching resource to need. Because whilst it's you're levelling the playing field on paper, but as you say, their contexts are completely different. And I think it said something like close to 60% of the schools in the most deprived areas of the country have seen a real terms funding cut, which obviously at a time when the kind of the national message is about levelling up, it kind of cuts across that quite badly, I think.
Indeed. Well, look, that seems like a hugely important story. It's on the website, linked to the report as well.
And speaking of leveling up as well, Dave, that's a phrase that's been used in another story that's up this morning, isn't it? In terms of the head teachers round table.
Indeed, It makes for quite inspiring reading, doesn't it, Catherine? This new report from the head teachers round table, who kind of saying that now is a perfect time to make some really big changes in the education system.
Yes, absolutely. So it really looks at quite a wide range of proposals. What we've sort of used as a top line is this argument about Ofsted. So this is quite a few of their proposals relate to the inspectorate, and their paper, which is called an alternative white paper for education, argues that the kind of high stakes nature of Ofsted has been unhelpful for schools, and that it's distracted leaders, or even at one point in the paper it says could have led to an exodus of head teachers because of the high pressure stakes of inspection. So they've made a number of proposals here about kind of how accountability judgment should be kind of put in the school's context, They've also said there should be kind of a national safeguarding service. So they said that safeguarding is too important to simply be left to kind of occasional inspection, and that there should be kind of a much more regular audit, kind of like a financial audit of schools and how they're doing on safeguarding. And so the report says Ofsted cannot be tasked with more responsibilities, such as inspecting sexual abuse in schools and colleges. And then the other proposals that it looks at are related to, for example, funding and also to assessment. So one of the things it talks about is that assessment in primary schools should be done on a kind of sampling basis rather than as a kind of national baseline.
So that would mean that primary school pupils wouldn't sit baseline tests, they wouldn't sit SATs, but you would just have a sample of pupils in each school doing those tests. Would that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it doesn't kind of go into detail on exactly how that would work, but it does say that that's suggested, I think, by the fact that it says that there could be a sample used, so that maybe it would only be like some primary school students who were sitting assessments, and that it wouldn't be sort of attached to the accountability system either. It would be very much just information that could be used by schools. And then in secondary, it's also got a kind of interesting suggestion about the way pupils are graded for GCSE and for A-level. So they think that there should be kind of established criteria for each grade in each subject in external exams. And so I suppose if students meet that criteria, then they get that grade. So essentially, it's kind of an argument against the bell curve and the way pupils are graded at the moment. And they refer to kind of the chaos in 2020. They say we saw how applying a statistical algorithm produces unrealistic outcomes. But of course, even prior to the pandemic, the grades pupils achieved were marked in a statistical way on a bell curve. So it seems to be kind of arguing against that and sort of saying, well, if you meet a certain threshold in English, it's not about where you fall in the cohort. You will just get that grade because you've met that external criteria. So some really kind of interesting thinking about lots of things. On funding, one of the things they particularly highlight is special educational needs funding. And they say that kind of for too long, that's been about budgeting and not about need, and that it really has to be matching need, not budget, so that pupils, for example, get proper kind of EHCP plans and that there's significant provision for pupils with special educational needs. And it points out that for some providers, they had 65% of pupils attending during the lockdown. So sort of it shows kind of that the need is there and how important it is for schools to stay open.
Well, it sounds like a hugely important report. It's on the website, isn't it, Catherine? And as are many other news stories about the world of education this week. So on that note, we shall leave it, and we'll see you all soon. Bye.
Yes.
Bye. Thanks.